last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer some doubts or misconceptions about the concept of Mahdaviyya or Mahdism, the last savior, which exists in almost all Abrahamic religions. The concept of expecting a savior to come. In this version, we are trying to discuss about the concept itself, the roots of this concept. Where are they rooted from? And this is what we are going to discuss and ask the questions from the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me. I was born in 1981 and I joined the Hausa Seminary of Qom in 1994, so it's about 25 years that I'm studying the Hausa Seminary of Qom. And beside fiqh and usul, or jurisprudence and the principles of jurisprudence, I have studied logic, Arabic literature and grammar, Islamic philosophy, and more importantly, Islamic theology. I also have my BA in Islamic theology from Imam Khomeini Institute for Education and Research in Qom. And then I continued my education on monotheistic religions. I mean, I had my MA in this field from the University of Religions and Islamic Denominations. And I have my PhD in Shia theology from University of Tehran. My PhD was about an analysis of the viewpoint of one of the false claimants with regards to the knowledge of the Imam.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day is actually a continuation of our previous discussion on the authenticity of akhbar and reports by Ka'b al-Ahbar and if they have any place in Shia worldview and Shia theology, and also if they are trusted narrators, and most specifically, their reports in the concept of occultation of the last Savior, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We have denied this issue that they have any place, any authenticity in Shia theology, and they are not known as the valid or trusted people in the science of hadith. Rather, we said that concerning Abdullah ibn Sabah, there is a sort of consensus among the ulama that he is not trusted. Also, there is no certainty that this person existed at the time that these reports are going to refer. The last question that we, I think, finished the show in our last episode was concerning the reports that we have received from Ka'b al-Ahbar and if they are related to the concept of Mahdawi occultation. Can you please shed some more light on this topic, Sheikh?
Sure. As I mentioned in the previous program, this part of the doubt mentioned by this Wahhabi scholar against Shia school of thought is pretty strange because of the fact that Shia scholars do not pay attention to the narrations quoted by Ka'b al-Ahbar, but rather when you refer to the Sunni sources, we see that there are many narrations quoted from Ka'b al-Ahbar. It's been mentioned in the Sunni sources that the second caliph used to consult with him. some great Sunni scholars have admired Ka'bul Ahbar as one of the greatest scholars who has an ocean of knowledge. And then we have great Sunni scholars and companions of the Prophet who have narrated the narrations of Ka'bul Ahbar, like Abdullah ibn Umar, Abu Huraira, Abdullah ibn Zubayr, and Abdullah ibn Amr ibn As, and so on and so forth. These are great Sunni personalities who all have narrated narrations from Ka'bul Ahbar. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Shia sources, you cannot find any Shia scholar who has admired Ka'bul Ahbar or has authenticated the narrations quoted by Ka'bul Ahbar. Even some believe that Ka'bul Ahbar did not believe in Islam. Deep in his heart, he was a fake Muslim. He just converted to Islam to bring about some false ideas and doctrines, and put them among the Islamic beliefs. And we know that we have some narrations known as Israiliyat, meaning that the narrations forged by those Jewish scholars who apparently or seemingly they converted to the religion of Islam. So there are doubts about the Islam of Ka'bul Ahbar as well. So to claim that the belief in occultation comes from the narrations of Ka'bul Ahbar is meaningless, as Shia do not believe in his narration.
Yeah. How about the idea of this concept being rooted in the teachings of Magi or Zoroastrian here, Magi meaning Zoroastrian? Definitely, as far as I have been concerned, Magi and Zoroastrians are different, Sheikhana. But the evidences in the question shows that this Magi here in this question referred to Zoroastrian. And Magi or Magals have been living apparently before the Zoroastrians. Anyhow, this is not related to the discussion of us today. Is there also any reason that these people have started this accusation against the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam to condemn them to be connected to the Zoroastrian teachings?
Is this part is also strange from this scholar because, I mean, these people who are anti-Shia, they are also anti-Iran as well, because Iran is the country with the majority of Ethna Asheri Shia population. Mm-hmm. So he has thought that maybe because Iranians mainly were Zoroastrian before Islam, and later they converted to Islam and Shiism, so they have brought about the concept of occultation based on the teachings of Zoroastrian people who used to live in Iran before Islam. But the point is that when we refer to the old and the first-hand books of Majus, he uses the word Majus referring to the Zoroastrians. These people, they do not believe in the concept of riba or occultation at all.
Or even, let's go before that. Do they believe in the imama or even the last savior with the viewpoint that we have on it?
They believe in a savior. Mm-hmm. So like any other
religions, they have such
a belief. They believe in a savior, and there is no doubt about that. But there are some differences between the viewpoints of Zoroastrians and the Muslims.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one my heart is to need you.
This Wahhabi scholar wants to prove that the Majus, they believed in riba of the Savior. Shia, who live in the same country, Iran, they took this idea from that religion, I mean from Zoroastrian. But the point is that when we refer to the books of so-called Majus, there is no trace of belief in riba or occultation. They believed that in the end of time, they have, long story that three sons will be born to Zartosh, their prophet. And finally, they call their savior as Sushant or Sushant, and they believe that he will come and save the world and the rest of the story. So you cannot find any trace of, occultation and Ghiba when you refer to the books of Zoroastrians. So again, it is a false idea to claim that the Shia have, taken this concept of occultation and Ghiba from Zoroastrians.
Yeah.
And of course, not all the Shia were from Iran. I mean, basically, the main companions of the Imams, they used to live in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, and many other countries. So they are not limited to the people living in Iran.
Okay.
And the next point, which is very important, is that, as I mentioned before, Shia belief in the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is rooted in narrations of the Prophet and the Imams. We have hundreds of narrations in Shia collections of hadith which talk about the fact that the last Imam will have occultation. Even it's been mentioned by the Prophet in some of the
narrations. Basically, there was no need to refer them
there
to
is no
any
need at
other,
all.
Let's say, sources like Zoroastrians or Kabul Akhbar or Abdullah ibn Saba.
But let's, suppose that Jewish people also believe in occultation. Majus also believe in occultation. Let's accept that. But if there is a similarity between one school of thought and one religion and another one, can one claim that, you have taken and you have borrowed that from that religion? As Muslims, we believe in monotheism. This Wahhabi scholar, does he accept that the Jewish people come and say that before you we believed in God, we believe in monotheism, and now you are saying the same, so you have taken this idea from us. You did not believe in that. You have borrowed this idea from us. Because we were the first people, for example, to believe in this idea. Or when it comes to the resurrection and the Day of Judgment, the Christians come to Muslims and say that, why do you believe in the Day of Judgment? Before you, we believe in that, and you shouldn't believe in that. You have borrowed that from us. This is not...
So every similarity is not necessarily going to mean something, like to find a sort of connection.
True. We can have a true doctrine which is shared by different schools of thought. So my point is that even if you accept that Jewish people believe in occultation, or, Abdullah ibn Saba believed in the occultation of Imam Mahdi, or, Zoroastrian believe in the concept of occultation, which we proved wrong. But even if you accept that this similarity, it doesn't mean that the Shia have taken this belief from them. This is only a similarity between two religions and two schools of thought. And when it comes to the Shia school of thought, we said that it's rooted in the narrations of the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtala, for the scholarly answer to the question. The interesting part of the point, Sheikh, is not only in the concept of occultation, or even the concept of Mahdawiya or Mahdism. In other issues, we see that when they want to accuse the school of Ahlul Bayt, they want to find a sort of connection to Zoroastrian or, let's say, Abdullah ibn Saba. I think this is because they find, this is my own understanding, that now Shia is growing in Iran, or was growing in Iran, and they found that basically in Iran there were some Zoroastrians. In order to make the way unclear for those who are the people of research, they want to start with this sort of accusation to hide the truth. Is it a true understanding of the situation? And just because, for example, a part of Iran, a very small part of Iran, Zoroastrians are living, and still they are living, and they are doing their own religious activities and worships. So they want to accuse the Shia or the school of Ahlul Bayt for this sort of connections.
I mentioned that usually these people, these Wahhabis who are anti-Shia, they are anti-Iran as well.
Yeah.
So they always look to say something which is against Shia and against Iran simultaneously. But the point is that As I mentioned again, there are many Shia of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt who did not live in Iran. I mean, Iran later became a center of the Shia. Before that, the Shia used to live in Arabian Peninsula and in countries like Iraq, in Jabal Amir, in Baalabak, and so on and so forth. So later, Iran became a center for Shia school of thought.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada, for your answers to the question, and you respected listeners. Many thanks for staying tuned and listening to The Last Savior from My Arab English Radio. I hope that this show was informative and beneficial to you. That's why I want to invite you to join us in our upcoming session. Till then, I live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Allahumma.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
حتى تسكنه